to In the Author Studio. We are the webcast and podcast with a different bent. We interview global authors, change agents, thought leaders around the world that are doing wondrous things in the worlds of change, transformation, innovation, futures, and growth. I'm excited today. I've got Tony Saldana. He not only has written a wonderful book called Why Digital Transformations Fail, we also share a previous company. His alma mater was Procter & Gamble. I spent about 7 years there. Tony beats me by a fair margin. I think he spent nearly 3 decades there. So welcome into the studio, Tony.
Oh, thank you very much. Thanks for having me, Sean.
Now, I know I'm going to, for somebody that's listening to this 4 months from now, my hope is we're all out and about and actually experiencing the world at large. But with all of the guests that I'm talking to this week and hopefully not too many weeks after, I'm just asking them, how are we coping with this pandemic that seems to have affected all of our lives? Any thoughts in terms of just learning new skills, experiencing the world differently?
Yeah, no, I'm doing three things. One is, learning to love my family and my dog, through a whole lot of new perspectives. Secondly, at work, taking the opportunity of, reduced travel to do more of the content creation. And the third is actually, just trying to, both for myself and for others, look at the fact that something good always comes out of these situations, whether it is, William Shakespeare's work or Newton's work that came out of similar lockdowns. So hard as it is, I'm sure there's got to be something good that comes out of this.
Yeah, no, it's great to keep that optimistic mindset. And I do agree with you. I find certain people are trying to be opportunistic in this era, but I think trying to reinvest in yourself is a great idea. Now, before we get into your book, I'd love to at least pump your tires up a little bit here because, you're certainly president of a digital transformation company called Transformant. Hopefully we'll get into that. You were vice president at Procter & Gamble of IT and global shared services. And much like my own experience in brand management, it seemed like every 3 years you might've been on the move to a different office or another. And you're an expert at building global ecosystems designed for exponential growth, organizational change, and disruptive tech. Have I left anything out there that are important things in your arsenal?
Oh no, that's enough pumping, Sean.
Well, I do find it interesting though. You're a tech person perhaps by trade, but you've been able to glom on these other things that I don't often characterize with many of the tech people that I know. Like, they're great at keeping the trains running on time and having things be cyber secure and know all the different kind of binary bits and bytes of what's going on. But the organizational stuff, the ability to actually innovate, sometimes is a bit of a, that Venn diagram is a little bit tighter for people that might have done your work previously.
Yeah, and as you correctly said, you and I, come from a background of having worked for a great company, Procter & Gamble, which at least in our case, has done a really good job of training us. I mean, I think P&G's reputation of a training ground is well deserved. And so, the 27 years that I spent there, I mean, I had the opportunity to do a lot of work from a technology standpoint, but my biggest takeaway from that time has been, on how to look at things from, more a business lens and a human and a people lens rather than a technology lens, which, as it turns out, has been incredibly useful because I consider digital transformation to be 90% about changing organization and change management and only 10% right. about technology.
It is interesting. I almost like the term business transformation more than digital transformation, but then it kind of gets lost in the ether perhaps. But I know you wrote a book. We're talking to authors. So you've defined yourself. Anybody smart that can pull 200 pages together on a subject. So And we were talking right before we got on to this webcast about how your title is a little bit deceptive. It's less kind of a forensics on the past and more about, some hopefulness to the future. So it's this weird paradox of both, a little bit of using evidence from the past, but more pointed toward the future. And the title is a little bit negative, right? Oh my Lord, 70% of these things fail, but your book is really a treatise on how to get it right.
That is correct, yes. You and I were joking about this. By the way, this, just a quick backstory. My original working title was Digital Takeoff, because what I've done is I've applied the airline checklist methodology to digital transformations to make it successful. And the first time I went to my wonderful publisher, who actually created the company Better Kohler, he said, this title's not gonna work. And I was really, really hurt. It's like, what do you mean? I mean, it's perfect. You know, Takeoff Positive, he said, you know, do me a favor, do a survey of SurveyMonkey of your friends. So I did, and I took it really seriously. I sent it out to 500 connections, and they all came back and said, that kind of worked, you know. He had suggested, my publisher had suggested, why digital transformations fail. And they said, that's the one. So I learned something through the process. But so the book is two things. One is, it is really a checklist, you know, inspired by the airline industry and subsequently the medical field of how to use checklists to be successful. And the second thing is that it's a book of hope. It basically comes from a practitioner's viewpoint of, you know, these are things that have helped me in the past.
Wonderful. No, I enjoyed the read. It's a breezy read, as much as it's more prose than kind of like a lot of graphics or whatever. You get through it quickly. And I find, I love the practitioner mindset. I find a lot of the books that enter into the space are from lifetime people that haven't, you know, had something riding on the line. It's kind of, whether it's academia or thought leaders, you've actually done the work in a company that I've worked for. So I know how difficult it is. I guess maybe one interesting jumping off point is, we've got a lot of really good checklists, and, you know, we'll hopefully get into how to become a stage five company, to use your vernacular, but how does this stuff play within corporate landscapes where sometimes just the day-to-day takes over people's lives?
And that's actually, one of the most interesting observations I have about digital transformation. The whole MBA, the corporate training that we've all been through previously, says that most good leaders do two things. They have an attention to detail on running the day-to-day, and then they constantly look for continuous improvement, right? So that's what GE and P&G and, you know, Total Quality and a whole bunch of other stuff has done. The realization that I had was that during industrial revolutions, that two-leg work plan is insufficient. You have to have a third leg. And that's what Google and Amazon and Netflix and all the others do very well. And that third leg is a very narrow leg, but it is also about disrupt yourself, right? So you would have to do the first two things. And then you also have to disrupt yourself. And I think just bringing that different perspective to the corporates and then showing them how to develop the work under that third leg becomes very important, because otherwise you're constantly making, you know, crazy trade-offs on, you know, between the first and the second leg and never have anything left for the third.
Yeah. Now you've got, I think to use, I think I saw a summary somewhere that was wrapped up about, okay, what's the why digital transformations fail for dummies, right? What are the key landmark things that you're trying to get across? And one of them said, you know, there's two core arguments. One, digital transformations oftentimes lack clarity. That's why they fail. And another one was they lack a process or a disciplined way of executing. Maybe talk a little bit about those two things in terms of just the umbrella of what you're talking about.
Yeah, you know, in fact, I often use Alice in Wonderland, the book, and the exchange between Alice and the Cheshire Cat as a representation of what happens in many companies vis-a-vis digital transformation. I mean, you know, the specific part of the book is where Alice asks the Cheshire Cat, you know, which way should I go? And the Cheshire Cat says, well, it depends on where you want to get to. She says, I don't care. Then he says, you know, fine. Then it doesn't matter which way you go, right? And I know that's tongue in cheek, but it's almost a little bit of what happens with digital transformations. You're exactly right. The two high-level reasons why digital transformations fail is clarity of goal setting, and the second is the methodology. On the first one, you know, as is true with any term that's been around for 40, 50 years and evolved in definition, digital and transformation means, you know, 100 different things to different people. So, you know, as part of the work that I did at P&G for about 3-4 years before I retired, I talked to 100 different organization leaders outside of P&G, 100 different organizations. And among other things, I asked the question, what is digital transformation? And I got a range of answers, everything from, oh, it's been around for a long time, don't worry about it, to the apocalypse of robots coming for us, right? So, and reality, I mean, it's a spectrum. And that's really what the 5-stage model, you know, drives, which is, you know, some clarity on what are you trying to get to. And then the second part is the methodology, which is digital transformation is still run out of IT project management methodology, which does a really good job of essentially making projects successful. But digital transformation has two other things. One is, as we said at the outset, it is as much organization change management as it's technology. And so we need to complement, you know, the IT stuff with it. And then the second thing is, when you're driving high risk, high return efforts, you need a venture capitalist mindset of, you know, I'm going to do 10 different things, 9 of them may fail, but, you know, only one of them is going to be successful, and manage for portfolio outcomes. Your job is not to make all 10 successful. And so building the methodology to do that is very important.
It's, I mean, you're stroking the cobbles of my heart here in terms of, you know, a corporate person that has some tolerance and acceptance of failure. Certainly if I put myself in circa 1995 era P&G, I don't know how tolerant my managers at the time would have been. I think, you know, I think there was probably some leeway, but, you know, certainly taking on the Silicon Valley approach isn't necessarily one that corporates tend to adopt even still. I've thrown up your 5-stage model here, and I think maybe some of those living DNA companies probably have really adopted that as their principle. It's almost, I would call your stage 5 like a digital first company, where it's just the mindset, the business model, the drivers of what makes them great are digital. And it's interesting, given this pandemic, maybe in a month's time, it took a pandemic to actually turn people into a digital mindset first. But talk to me about the 5 stages here and maybe where you think most companies reside right now.
Yeah, so, you know, back to the point about how do you really define digital transformation. In retrospect, after having, you know, done this work for about 3 decades, what struck me is that the best framework of describing what I've been doing more recently may have been industrial revolutions, because in times of industrial revolutions, as I was saying, it's not just continuous improvement, you know, run the day-to-day, but also disrupt yourself. And so if that's the case, if we have to have strategies for continuous improvement, then the only correct definition of digital transformation should be, how do you rewire organizations that are successful in the third industrial revolution to become successful in the 4th industrial revolutions? And so, therefore, the only correct definition of successful digital transformation is rewiring the you know, of course, the systems and stuff like that, but also the people, the living DNA of the organization. And for me, that's what stage 5 is. You know, it's how do you make yourself into a Netflix, which, you know, within 20 years has disrupted itself 4 times, from mail and DVDs to streaming media to original content to international models. And so, working backwards from that, where most companies, you know, get lost in digital transformation is, they may think that what their IT shops drive in terms of, we want to be a cloud first strategy, we want to have, you know, a small group of people in Silicon Valley doing AI, that is not digital transformation. That is, you know, most IT stuff is foundation digitalization. You know, you take things that are physical and you turn them digital. That's not digital transformation. That's creating a foundation for rewiring the company, but that's not it, right? And then they go to silo, where maybe, you know, one division or one country starts to reimagine itself and says, you know, how about we operate like we were a digital first company? And then they go from there to, I think, where most of the companies are, which is what I call partially synchronized. It's where the company has decided that we need to have a digital strategy, a la General Electric under Jeff Immelt. And then they even make efforts to actually have a corporate strategy and some work. But in execution, all of these efforts are only partially synchronized. The digital officer drives an agenda. The day-to-day people drive their own agenda. They're not completely synchronized. Some companies eventually get to fully synchronized, where all of the efforts are fully synchronized. They may even transform themselves at one time, but they haven't actually changed their organization's DNA. So the culture element, the people element's not done. And so the reason I offered this framework was, you know, rather than trying to take on the IT industry sales guys and their brilliant ability to, you know, take any buzzword and translate whatever they're providing into that buzzword, I said, you know, let's provide a framework for decision makers, CEOs and IT people, to kind of see themselves on where they stand within that buzzword and therefore set better goals.
Wonderful. I love the framework. I mean, obviously, it's a great benchmarking tool to know kind of where you are. I think even took this tool one step further, if I'm right here. Yes. You've got like more of the checklist approach. And I know we could cover all 10 of these, but I was very curious on your bookends, you know, as a foundational kind of piece. It's often very popular to say, you know what, there was this hero's journey and there was this insurrection inside an organization, you know, on the front lines, and it percolated up and, oh my Lord, they resist against their leadership and the enemy and they triumphed. And certainly the reality in writing my book, Wikibrands, a number of years ago, in 98% of the cases, if leadership wasn't at least a tacit approver, if not, you know, cheerleader at the front of the parade, you probably weren't going too far. It sounds like it may be your experience, with a caveat that, you know, even though leadership's on side, there's probably a numerous amounts of iteration to get your plan right.
That is absolutely true. Yeah. And so, you know, with the 10 checklists, all of which are in the book and on the website, what I'm trying to do is, you know, give organization leaders a little bit of a cookbook that says, you know, for the next 2 years, if all you want to do is set your goal to be very good at stage two, then this is what you absolutely have to get correct at stage two. And in 5 years, if you want to be at stage five, this is what you have to do to get to stage five. And so none of these 10 steps are skippable, if that's even a word. But, you know, what you have to do is make sure that you're not failing. And you can, of course, accelerate the journey. Right? But to your point on leadership, to go back to it, even if all you're doing is automating, you know, the way you run brand management or, you know, financial accounting, we know that there's a difference between, you know, leaders that sponsor the efforts and delegate and others that truly get you know, what is now being called out as an important element of digital transformation, skin in the game, which, you know, Steve Jobs actually articulated a long time ago. And that's your experience as well, Wikibrands, which is, you know, if the leader clearly has skin in the game, is willing to do what it takes to not just be a figurehead, but to do three other things, to step in and break barriers, to envision what things look like, and then to spend enough time to engage. You know, that's what committed leadership is all about.
And I wanted to tackle your 9 and 10 here too. I love to always say that, you know, whether it's transformation or innovation change, there is no finish line. And it's always popular, yes, to have the big sales conference where people pop out of cakes and we've done it. We're finally accomplished something here. And I think your 9 and 10 belie the fact, if you want to get to be a stage five, you know, digitally transformed company, it's, you know, there's a constant state of culture and agile and sensing the world around you and assessing it, right?
You've got it exactly. You know, and that's the reason why Jeff Bezos says Amazon will get disrupted. It's not a question of whether, but you know, when. That's the same reason why, you know, during my book launch event here in Cincinnati, one of the members of the audience said, you know, a few years ago, we used to go to MapQuest because that was so disruptive. rather than look at the physical maps. And now, where is MapQuest today? And that's exactly it, right? I mean, to constantly disrupt yourself, to go from being MapQuest to being, Google Maps, basically means you have to be driven by an internal culture that understands that, you know, your time in the 15 minutes of fame is limited. And unless you go ahead and allow your organization to keep evolving, the agility to kind of disrupt yourself over and over again, somebody else is definitely going to get there, right? And the issue vis-a-vis that is always about timing, right? We all know that, the need to disrupt yourself is there, and you know, that's nothing new. The question always is timing. You know, if you basically cry wolf too early, you wasted resources. If you wait too late, then, you know, you're dead, right? And so what I try to do with sensing risk is actually give leaders a measurement system that you know, in real time, give them an early warning heads up display on, hey, you know, this is starting to get red, you know, you guys better get on with it.
Interesting. It's always tough. I oftentimes look at transformation as a game of golf. Golf is very intimidating as you look forward. But when you look back in time, it's like, oh, of course we made that mistake. Or of course Netflix would have been very successful. Although at the time, whoever was in Netflix making those calls would have been making some courageous steps, or in golf parlance, shots into the future, right? So
exactly, yes.
We're interviewing a whole bunch of authors. Some of their books are 30 years old. Yours is pretty fresh. It came out last year, I think last July, if I'm not mistaken.
That is correct, yes.
It's about a year in. What's been the reaction? Would you have, in looking at the printed page that the ink is now dry, would you have written it any differently? Certainly we're in a different era right now in terms of this pandemic we're in. Are there thoughts in terms of what you've seen post-book launch?
So there's a couple of things. There's a part of me, I think this comes with having been trained at P&G, which is always looking for feedback on what you can do differently. So as I open my book these days, there are pages where I cringe a little bit. It's like, what? You know, I could have framed that much better. But in any case, so that's one thing. But, you know, the second thing is, to be fair to the book, the response has been gratifying. I mean, you know, it's into its third print run in India the first print run in India ran out in the market, you know, like within a week of launch. And then, you know, even globally, I think we've had, you know, five or six different language translations. And in the US, I mean, it started off being number one on Amazon's hot new releases list for organization change, and, you know, has done fairly well. So none of which, by the way, I could have predicted, in the sense that, you know, my initial reaction going in was, who on earth is going to be interested in an IT and shared services leader's historical perspective? So obviously, you know, there's something worth it.
You have more cachet and swing than you think, I suppose.
So it's been fun. But, you know, back to your question on pandemic. I think I could never have imagined, you know, as you were saying earlier on, that, you know, once the burning platform arrives, how quickly you can, you know, have people, leaders, and organizations move. I mean, you know, I was looking at, you know, not just the sales figures, although they don't publish them, but, you know, the subscription numbers informally available for Zoom, which is what we're recording this on, you know, a 20 times jump. And how everybody from, you know, grandmothers to you know, people seeking doctor's appointments. I mean, so not just corporate people, but, you know, people that never really thought about them being, you know, interested in video conferencing. Now this has become part of their life. And so, you know, it's amazing once the change arrives, you know, how quickly you can get people onto it. And that's what digital transformation and about being fully committed to it is all about. And you know, that's maybe a stark example that I would never have thought about, but, you know, here we are.
I love, I'm a big Hemingway fan, and his book, The Sun Also Rises, it's like he talks about bankruptcy and how it comes gradually and then suddenly. And I think maybe that's what we're looking at here, maybe.
Exactly, yes.
Now, I know we're taking a little bit of a contribution from Robert Lipton and his In the Actor Studio, where he always asks the same questions at the end of his interviews with his actors. It's interesting to benchmark all these different authors now in terms of how they ask. Are you ready to go through our rapid fire repertoire of about 12 different questions here, Tony?
I'm ready to go with one caveat. I'm going to tell you the outcome. In the benchmarking, I'm going to end up being dead last. And if you're okay with that, let's go for it.
Once again, you're underselling your shared services background and how interesting it may be for people. So first question we ask, what's overhyped? What's the thing nowadays that you're looking at? I don't care where you go with this one. What do you feel is like totally overhyped right now?
I think at this point in time, I think artificial intelligence, blockchain as a technology is overhyped. What's underhyped is use cases that are ready. And so that distinction between technology and use cases, technology is overhyped, use cases are underhyped.
Okay, let's go to the flip side of the coin. What's underhyped? What's totally underappreciated by our peer set?
What's underappreciated is how very specific use cases, I was saying, of technology are already there. So, you know, 3 years ago, I was talking with I was actually emailing a CEO of a company, trying to get a time to talk. And that company was already using AI robots as calendaring assistants, right? So this use case was ready several years ago. Large companies would never think of using it. But, you know, here we are, you know, today Microsoft makes it available as a service.
Yep. What's your favorite quote? You have a lean-to quote that you always go back to?
Yeah, in my case, it is, you know, if it is to be, it is up to me. I really feel like that's got to be defining of big change.
I like that. I like that a lot. And then to stoke my, I guess, what would it be, my left brain, do you have a favorite stat?
Unfortunately, it has to be the fact that, you know, in a $1.7 trillion industry of digital transformation, 70% of projects fail.
That's the one that hits you in the gut, doesn't it? Yes. Who would you invite over for a change maker supper? So it's interesting. We're close to Good Friday on this one. So I don't know if there's religious connotations here, but who would you invite over? Go off the list if you want.
I'm very boring that way. If I had to invite somebody, I would probably go with Jeff Bezos. And I know he's a controversial figure. I mean, you know, his personal style is not what you'd want, you know, every leader to emulate sometimes. But, you know, he's the guy that I think saw that the world would, Amazon was going to be the world's marketplace, not just a bookseller store, but was humble enough to start and make one slice successful and then keep building from there. And that's what I admire about him.
Hey, that's a good choice, man. It's the wealthiest choice. The dinner would be. if you were 23 again, I do love asking this question because we can all reinvent our lives over again. Maybe there are no regrets, but if you're 23 again, knowing what you know now, what would you be doing?
I think one thing I would be doing differently is, you know, I would be paying a lot more attention to the creativity side and the emotional intelligence side of my personality. It's actually funny in the sense that when people ask me, you know, for their children, what should they study? I mean, should they all become programmers? And I keep saying, no, I mean, I think creativity and the softer side is going to be even more important as, you know, you've got machines take over the more mechanical stuff. I mean, you, of course, don't get me wrong. Please, everybody has to have a basic understanding or maybe even a basic education of technology for the future. But unless it's complemented by the softer skills, I don't think it's useful enough.
I love it. It's at least one way to stay ahead of the robots, right? So. when was the last time you were blindsided by a marketplace shift?
Oh my God. I mean, I would say even the example of Zoom video conferencing recently. And it kind of hits home because when I was at P&G, I actually looked at Zoom about 4 years ago and said, hey, what's different between that and what Skype and Microsoft has to offer? And I completely dismissed it. You know, there you go. You know, how wrong you can be on stuff like that.
Yeah. Same thing with Slack, I find too, right? Like it's the question of, do you take the really good utility tool over here, or do you take the well-integrated piece over here, i.e. Microsoft or whatever? I find Zoom falls in that same bucket. Yes. Last couple of questions here. What companies do you most admire that we probably have heard of? Like the notorious ones, which ones?
Yes. I've mentioned Amazon a couple of times, but and again, I'm going to be extremely boring, but the other person and the other company that I follow very closely is Tesla and SpaceX. I mean, you know, most people don't realize that, you know, SpaceX is now shooting off batches of, you know, like 60 to 100 different satellites. And very soon, maybe within a year or so, there's going to be more SpaceX satellites around the world than there are existing country satellites. And therefore, internet connectivity, high speed, not through your Wi-Fi and landline connections, but, you know, through space. Within a couple of years, it's going to be dramatically different. And so, you know, these are companies led by, you know, obviously visionary leaders that have the ability to look into the future and make things happen.
It's amazing. I wonder at the end of Musk's life what his legacy may be. It may be less about cars and energy and more about, you know, maybe how he got us to Mars, right? So,
yes, exactly.
Sure. All right, you know where the next question is. What are the companies that we likely haven't heard of, or those like undiscovered gems that you may have run across in your travels?
So there are two or three more in the realm of startups that for me are incredibly inspirational. So there is a small company that in Rwanda and in parts of Africa, they got written up in the newspapers recently. That are basically using modified drones and aeroplanes to send necessary blood to hospitals. They've been doing this now for about 4 years, right? At a time where everybody dismissed, you know, drone delivery and stuff like that, these guys are saving lives in incredibly different conditions in Africa. You know, somewhat unsurprisingly, my other inspiration also comes from Africa. You know, there is another startup that uses blockchain in Kenya to essentially help farmers there set up an own marketplace for exchange and selling of grain crops, right? And obviously, these startups are humanitarian, you know, kind of good oriented. But what they're doing is going to change the world. I mean, I think it's going to bring high technology, so whether it's blockchain or drones or whatever it is, humanitarian causes, and find ways to monetize it. And that's what for me is, these are the examples that I love to keep in front of me.
It's amazing you've chosen African ones, right? We had somebody on one of our webcasts and they were like, they have no legacy system. So all of it's new, right? You're not burdened.
Yes.
I mean, the handicap of not having it is you're not burdened by it either, right? So interesting. All right, last couple. How would others describe you as a change maker and impact maker? What would be the proudest descriptor people could characterize you as?
Oh my God. You know, this is always embarrassing, but you know, I think I would be happy if people said of me, you know, he was persistent.
Yeah, hey, resilience and persistence is half the battle in this era, isn't it? What tech or element of innovation are you spending a lot of time with? Are you playing with and kind of looking at?
So, two things. One is again in AI and blockchain. So I've got a couple of companies that I founded. One of them is looking at tokenizing software algorithms. Now it's very easy to tokenize because you can describe and you can codify physical things, you know, like pricing, like product, like, you know, where does a piece of vegetable originate from, you know, that kind of stuff, because you can use data to describe it. software algorithms, where, you know, you just change a little bit of code there and you have a different product or harder to tokenize. But again, you know, this is something that the musical industry has already broken that code, in the sense that if you can do digital rights management, you know, then you can codify algorithms. And so that's the kind of stuff that I'm playing around with these days.
Very neat. We're in the hype cycle on blockchain, aren't we? It's like we've troughed out, and my hope is there's a glide scope up, because I think there are some interesting real life applications. The last one, we try to humanize our authors. I love this book, other book called Range, where it's like generalists will rule the world. My hope is there's a number of different other things going on in your life. What do you do for fun?
I I'm a tinkerer. I do everything from, you know, remodeling kitchens to painting to, you know, these days of enforced confinement, trying my hand out with a few things in the kitchen. My latest projects is to basically figure out how I can get into my garage and try and create a garage of the future. So we'll see where that takes us.
That is amazing. Not only is it amazing, it's very male in focus too, right? Like
it is. It is stereotypical.
Nice. I'll let you jump on a soapbox for 30 seconds here. You're now heading up something called Transformant. I was on your website earlier today. I hopefully caught you at the right snap frame of you looking smart in front of the crowd here. I think you had a video B-roll on the back of your big banner. What's it all about?
So Transformant is basically a first of a kind company that brings together, you know, the checklist methodology of how to be successful in digital transformation. It's a first of a kind in the sense that, you know, it brings the best in class thinking on, as we were saying, the methodology of digital transformation. But then secondly, I also rely on a network of literally 3,000 people all over the world that run, you know, local organizations that are available anywhere in the world. So I can pull best-in-class resources against any of these efforts at any time. And we do work with maybe about, you know, 20 of the Fortune 100 companies, advising boards and CXOs all the way through to, you know, some execution work, of course.
Wonderful. Seems like a really good transition from what you did previously inside companies and now taking it outside. So I'm sure they benefit from it. This has been quite enjoyable. As much as you've, I want to pay you two compliments. One, as much as I've found within this pandemic era, other authors have got back really quick. You expect kind of maybe a few days to transcribe. You are like quicker than all of them. So from a agile, living it out in real life, I think you're doing that. So I appreciate that. But as well on this one, I think you undersold yourself in terms of just personalizing this whole space of change. I think I've enjoyed just kind of peering behind the book to see what makes you tick. So I appreciate your time today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure to, you know, reconnect with an old alum. And, you know, it's always easy because we're always on the same wavelength. But thank you so much for doing this.
And in closing, I just want to say we're doing a number of these actually this week, and they can be located here at futureproofingnext.com in the author studio, and we'll probably post these in various syndicated podcasts and webcasts and YouTube environments and using the hashtag in the author studio. Once again, I want to thank Tony for joining us today, and we look forward again to seeing you in the future.